10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering a research-based master's degree in biological sciences, covering diverse topics from ecology to molecular biology. With a 90% placement rate, become a leader in a science field that is shaping the future. Details are available at uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This happens to be National Wildlife Week, and I am very happy that we can celebrate that with David Mazeski, who is a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation. And we have spoken with David before about the great work that he does as a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation. And we're going to find out a little bit about his own nearly lifelong fascination with what we see and experience in the outdoors. And we will find out about the work of the National Wildlife Federation, particularly as it plays out during this very special week during the year. David Mazeski, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. So first of all, let's give you a chance to tell our listeners a little bit about your own wonderful love of the outdoors and the world of nature and the beginning of all that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, first I'll start by explaining what a naturalist is, since not everybody knows necessarily. A naturalist is basically somebody who studies the natural world and has sort of a deep knowledge of wildlife and plants and ecology. And in addition to that, it also helps communicate about it and does that in a way, at least for me, hopefully that inspires people to want to get involved in conservation efforts to save our natural world and our fellow species. And so, you know, there's lots of different people over history who have been naturalists, everyone from Charles Darwin to Jane Goodall to David Attenborough. There are some of the more famous ones, but, you know, literally anybody can be a naturalist. You know, if you enjoy going outside and watching the birds or, you know, going on hikes and identifying the plants and learning about nature, well, you're a naturalist too. And for me, you know, I kind of joke and I always say, you know, I sort of was born this way. I was one of those kids that just was naturally drawn to being outside and to animals and, you know, spent my youth running around in the woods and climbing trees and catching frogs and all that kind of thing. And, you know, ultimately went on to get a degree in human and natural ecology. And I've been with the National Wildlife Federation going on 21 years. It'll be 21 years this summer, working as a naturalist in a lot of different of our programs that, again, are designed to help educate people and inspire them to want to get involved in our conservation efforts. Mm. One of which, of course, is National Wildlife Week, which we're going to talk about.
Very good. I find it interesting that the National Wildlife Federation was created, if I remember correctly, in 1936.
And that is correct. Yep.
And of course, so it was created at a time in our nation's history that was exceedingly difficult on a lot of different fronts. Is there anything you can tell us about the creation of the National Wildlife Federation, and in particular, why it sprang up when it did?
Sure. Yeah, no, that's actually a really interesting point, because you're right. At that point in time, you know, we were coming out of the Great Depression, and it was a very challenging time for our country. it was a very challenging time for our nation's wildlife as well. And that's because, you know, back then we didn't have the regulation and the oversight over the management and the stewardship of our natural resources. And that includes wildlife. So, you know, this is the era when, you know, the Industrial Revolution and the rapid development of North America and unfortunately, a lot of our wildlife suffered. So, you know, hunting was not regulated. And, you know, whether it was, you know, people, you know, shooting all of the bison on the Great Plains or killing millions of our nation's waterfowl for the plumes to put in fashion hats for women, you know, there was just all of this decimation of our wildlife. And even though we were facing a tough economic situation, you know, there were people that recognized that we were sort of on the edge of really losing our nation's natural heritage, and that is something worth saving and worth protecting, and that, you know, it the American sort of model of conservation is that belongs to all of us. You know, as Americans, our natural heritage belongs to everybody in America, and it's our right to, you know, have it and enjoy it and to know that it's there for future generations. And so a fellow named Ding Darling, who actually was a political cartoonist and got, you know, sort of a mover and shaker in Washington, was able to convince the powers that be that this was something that they should be talking about. And he ended up convening a convention where he invited all of the people of all the different flavors that are out there or that were out there in America at the time to come together, focusing on this sort of shared value of conserving wildlife and our natural heritage. And so from the very get-go, this was basically the seed of what became the National Wildlife Federation. And so from the very get-go, we have been an organization that really values that diversity and bringing people together, again, on that shared value. And so at that very first meeting, there were a lot of hunters and anglers, you know, who were concerned because the wildlife that they wanted to go out hunting and fishing for were disappearing right before their eyes. But there were also, you know, the birders, people who enjoy just watching wildlife. There were even people who were getting into the early, you know, sort of garden for wildlife kind of movements that we've really spearheaded at the National Wildlife Federation. People who just enjoyed, you know, hiking and camping and things. And they all came together from all across the country and, you know, said, you know, this is a priority for all of us, even from all of these diverse sort of perspectives. And out of that was formed the National Wildlife Federation. And to this day, that kind of remains our model. We are a true federation. So we're a national nonprofit organization, and we have regional offices around the country. But we also have state affiliates, and these are separate nonprofit organizations, one per state and territory, that we literally federate together. And by doing so, it kind of elevates our voice. And that diversity is still there today. So, you know, some of our affiliates are very traditional wildlife conservation groups, you know, hunting and fishing groups. We also have very sort of progressive green groups as some of our affiliates and everything in between. And, you know, that diversity is, you know, gives power and strength, because when you can bring people together from across the political spectrum to really say, you know, we all care about wildlife and natural resources, you know, that gets people's attention in Washington, and that's a powerful thing. And so that's, you know, kind of a little bit of the history of the National Wildlife Federation. And of course, we do a whole wide range of work. Some of it is that policy and legislation focused work. You know, some of it is species specific. Some of it is on, you know, huge systemic problems like climate change. But we also do a lot of work on the local level and getting communities involved in greening their communities. We do a lot of work focused on getting the next generation connected to nature and giving them opportunities to learn about nature, whether that's Ranger Rick magazine, which we've been publishing for over 50 years, or our programs like Eco Schools USA. I mentioned the Garden for Wildlife movement, which we had been instrumental in founding back in the 70s and continue to promote today. This is all about helping wildlife that live in our cities and towns and neighborhoods, and, you know, attracting birds and butterflies and supporting their populations where people live. So we do a tremendous amount of diverse work at the National Wildlife Federation, but at its core is this idea that, you know, wildlife is part of our natural heritage and it's a shared value, you know, across the spectrum. And that, you know, if we can all focus on that shared value, we're going to make sure we have a future where wildlife are in it. And that's our mission, to unite all Americans to ensure that wildlife thrive in a rapidly changing world.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with David Mizajewski, who is a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation. And this is National Wildlife Week. And so it's a great opportunity to reconnect with David to talk about the good work of the National Wildlife Federation and to find out some ways in which each of us can celebrate National Wildlife Week. It's funny, the day before we are recording this interview, so yesterday for me, several days ago for our listeners, on my way to the radio station, I saw a huge skunk just two blocks away from our studios, and there were a couple of different cars that were stopped just to sort of watch this really big and beautiful skunk in broad daylight, actually. And about an hour later, when I found my way driving the other direction on the same street, it was one block away, but still absolutely in full view. And again, a couple of cars had stopped just to kind of view the thing. And in a sense, it was one of those amazing moments where, for all that surrounds us and with which we interact in terms of media and technology and so on, there's nothing quite like encountering a wildlife creature in an unexpected place at an unexpected time.
You know, you're so right about that. And, that's a little bit of what our theme for National Wildlife Week is. It's about celebrating America's diverse wildlife. And those kinds of encounters really are magical. You know, I mean, the reality is that most wildlife species are relatively elusive. They don't want to be seen or be around people. And it's, you know, even if they're present, usually you don't see them. And so getting a visual like that can be really, really special. Again, especially for kids, you know, I mean, that's the kind of experience that really could light the flame of a love for wildlife in a kid. And I have to say, I have to give you, props for looking at a skunk and not immediately being fearful or thinking, oh, we got to get rid of that, right? These are animals that can perfectly happily coexist with us as long as you follow the golden rule. And the golden rule is, this goes for any wild animal. If you don't try to get near it, touch it, pick it up, pet it, feed it, you're not going to have any problems with it, right? And so skunks are not going to come after you to spray you. If you threaten them, they will defend themselves by spraying you, and they'll give you lots of warnings in advance. So, you know, yet we still have this sort of knee-jerk reaction to animals like skunks that, you know, it's kind of like, get rid of them. And so I want to thank you for just immediately not having that reaction. And that's kind of what we're trying to change, some of those perceptions or misperceptions about wildlife. And speaking of misperceptions, I do also want to address the fact that this animal is walking around during daylight. Now, again, we have this sort of urban myth that if you see an animal in daylight, that it means it's sick. And, you know, certainly that can happen if an animal is sick. It can alter its natural behavior. But the sign that an animal is sick is not that it's out during the day. The sign that an animal is sick is that it's behaving sickly, right? And so a lot of times in our suburban or urban areas where animals are forced to sort of be around people every single day, you know, oftentimes they get a little bit more comfortable with us. And as long as they're not harassed, they are sometimes more comfortable being out during daylight hours. So, you know, just because you see an animal like a skunk or a raccoon or a fox or something like that active during daylight hours doesn't automatically mean that they're sick. And again, if you don't approach that animal, you know, even if there is an illness present, you know, you're not going to be in any danger from it.
Very good. So, one of the things we hear is about increasing encroachment of wildlife into urban areas. And of course, we're in a sense accusing them of the encroachment when in fact it's really, I suppose, more the other way around, that we have encroached into their habitats. And at some point, the two begin to kind of rub against each other. And certainly there are certain instances in which this can have tragic consequences when we're talking about certain kinds of wildlife. And in many other cases, it's a much more benign sort of coexistence. In general, should we be happy about this, about the fact that more and more in an urban area, one is likely to see, I don't know, coyotes or wild turkeys or other kinds of creatures? Or is it best if we are not in quite such close proximity with one another?
Well, I think it's a good thing. And to your point, you know, these animals are not encroaching on us. We've encroached on them. And in many cases, you know, take the wild turkey, for example, the fact that these animals are even present is a testament to the success of wildlife conservation. Wild turkeys are a species that, you know, we were talking about a minute ago about in the old days before things like hunting and fishing, you know, were regulated and managed by like actual science, you know, the wild turkey was almost completely wiped out from overhunting and habitat destruction. And so in the last several decades, you know, we have focused on that species in conservation and, you know, protected its habitat and restored its habitat and done captive breeding programs and reintroductions. And now wild turkeys are fairly common. And in some cases, you do sometimes see them in our kind of urban and suburban areas where you might not think they would be. So, yeah, I think that's something to be celebrated. The other thing that is, I think, something that should be celebrated is that often the species that can coexist with us, it's because they're very adaptable animals. They're not too dissimilar from we humans, right? And they can survive in a wide range of environments and you know, sort of pressures from changes in the natural environment. And that's not true for most species, right? If you think about it, most species decline and disappear and maybe even go extinct as a result of the way that we human beings change the landscape. But there are a handful of species that have that sort of magic of adaptability. You know, things like raccoons that, you know, pretty much have expanded their range because they are able to, like us, live in a wide variety of scenarios. And so I think that's something to be celebrated. The fact that, you know, even though we have radically altered the natural environment, there are some species that can still thrive in that. And of course, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be protecting the more natural areas for all the rest of the species. But I think that that's a good thing. And again, I go back to my golden rule. You know, these animals can coexist with us without any issue as long as we don't mess with them. And that's true in almost all scenarios. You know, using raccoons as an example, yes, can they be pesky? Yes, they can get into our trash cans. But the solution to that is get a trash can with a lid that snaps shut. Use bungee cords. Don't put your trash out at, you know, the night before pickup. Do it in the daylight hours when, again, the raccoons are less likely to get to it. You know, most of these potential wildlife conflicts in our urban and suburban areas can usually be solved with just some simple behavior changes on our part. And so I think it's a great thing that we're seeing more and more wildlife species sharing our space with us. And in fact, last thought on it is that if we really do want to save and protect and restore our wildlife populations, it's not enough to just focus on the wilderness areas, which are ever shrinking. So much of the land is actually taken up by the human footprint, that we actually need to make space for wildlife in our cities and our towns and our neighborhoods if we're really going to be able to protect and restore a lot of these species. And, you know, the beauty is most of these animals are you know, it's not the bigger animals, right? It's not, you know, bears and moose that we're talking about. A lot of the animals that can benefit from habitat in our cities and towns and neighborhoods are things like songbirds, which have declined precipitously in this country. In fact, a study came out not too long ago that showed that the North American bird population is down by almost 3 billion birds in just the last 50 years or so.
Wow.
So there's 3 billion less birds overall in the population. And, you know, these are animals that, again, if we just give them some habitat, you know, and in the case of birds, that's planting trees. It's planting native plants that are going to supply them with natural seeds and berries and insects, you know, not spraying pesticides. We can all do that. And if we do that, many of these birds will really, really benefit, and maybe their populations will start to come back. Same thing for butterflies. The monarch butterfly is in real trouble. You know, we all grew up seeing the monarch butterfly, and probably the first insect other than maybe a ladybug or a bee that we could identify as a kid. They're disappearing. The western population west of the Rockies, there's less than 1% of them left. The eastern population is down by, you know, it's been down as much as 90%. It, you know, changes year to year. But at any rate, these are animals that we can help. We can save right in our own backyards. And so, again, I mentioned our Garden for Wildlife movement. That's something that we really are going to be focusing on in the month of May. So maybe I can come back and talk more about that then. But at any rate, we can make space for wildlife and share our, again, our cities, our towns, our neighborhoods, whether it's urban, suburban, or rural. And if we do that, we can actually make a big difference.
Before we talk specifically about some ideas on how to celebrate National Wildlife Week, I wonder if you could just say a word about how life has changed for you and your colleagues during the COVID-19 pandemic. In what way has the National Wildlife Federation had to change what it does or the way it does things during this difficult period?
Well, it's an interesting question. We, like everyone else, has really had to shift and alter the way we do our work. And I'm happy to say that we've been able to pivot, I think, pretty successfully. So our offices closed last March, and they remain closed. So the entirety of the Wildlife Federation staff are working remotely. And so that, you know, of course, has presented some huge challenges. But I have to say we were a little bit ahead of the curve because we had already started using Zoom. And I think at this point in the game, we're all Zoom experts. But a year ago, a lot of companies and organizations, you know, were not familiar with that kind of platform. And we had already been using it at the National Wildlife Federation, so that helped us. But, you know, it's been pretty incredible that we, in my opinion, that we've been able to, you know, really not stop the work, right? We've remained dedicated to our mission and focusing on wildlife and getting a tremendous amount of work done, even under the challenge of COVID-19. And so, you know, we're going to, as a conservation organization, as a science-based organization, we're going to follow the best science and the best recommendations on when it's going to be safe to reopen. And, you know, we're obviously having lots of conversations about what that means. You know, what does the new normal look like in terms of our offices and how they're arranged and what our policies are going to be and things like that. But, you know, I'm hoping that everybody out there listening is, you know, continuing to take this seriously, you know, focus on getting your vaccinations and still wearing your mask and social distancing, because it's going to take all of us working together for the common good to really help, you know, eliminate this pandemic so that we can all get back to some sense of normal.
Very good. So in the last few minutes that we have, I would love to have you share with our listeners some ideas on ways that they might be able to celebrate National Wildlife Week over the next several days.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, like we mentioned at the top, National Wildlife Week is happening this week. This is something we've been doing for decades, and it's just one week of the year where we really try to get the message out about how amazing our wildlife are. And because we're National Wildlife Federation, most of our work really is actually focused on our American wildlife species, on North America. And so this year, our theme is celebrating the beauty and diversity of America's wildlife. And I have to tell you, I had a lot of fun working on putting this campaign together with my colleagues, because it was my task to come up with, well, what are some of these interesting and unique wildlife species? And, you know, believe it or not, there's some pretty amazing species that call the U.S. home that a lot of people don't even know about. And some of them are pretty weird. Like, we have got a species that looks like a pig that isn't a pig at all. It's called a javelina or a collared peccary. And it only lives in the desert Southwest. And so if you're not from, you know, Arizona or New Mexico or West Texas, you probably have never even heard of this animal. And they, again, they look like pigs. They're about the size of a German Shepherd. They actually are backyard wildlife. They will, you know, roam neighborhoods just like in other places you see deer. And they're just fascinating. And there are a group of animals called peccaries that look like pigs. They have a very, what we call, convergent evolution. They've got a snout and the same body shape, but they're actually very different animals and not really closely related. You know, in your neck of the woods, there's an animal called the southern flying squirrel that most people have no idea is out there, but they're just as common as the gray squirrel that is ubiquitous in our backyards. It's just the flying squirrels are nocturnal, and they hang out up in the tops of the trees, and so most people never see them because we're not active then. So, you know, this year for National Wildlife Week, we're celebrating that. And if folks go to our website, it's nationalwildlifeweek.nwf.org, or just Google National Wildlife Week, it'll take you there. And we've set up a whole bunch of different ways that people can get involved. You know, being a voice for wildlife, we've got a pledge, and we're hoping people will take this pledge that literally just says, we're gonna use our voice to help the National Wildlife Federation protect and restore wildlife. And when you take the pledge, we have a really cool prize pack that five people are going to win. It's called the Wildlife Gear and Go, and it's basically just a set of stuff that will help you get outdoors and experience nature. A really great fleece, a National Wildlife Federation hat, a cooler, so when you're out hiking or camping, you can bring some cold drinks, stuff like that. So definitely do that. And we have partnered this year with BuzzFeed. And if folks are familiar with BuzzFeed, you know that they are a social media website that is famous for their quizzes. And they do all sorts of crazy, wacky quizzes. So they have created a quiz that will tell you what unique wildlife species your personality best matches. Again, we had a lot of fun building this. So you can access all of that on the National Wildlife Week website. Take the quiz and you'll learn what animal you are and how you can get involved protecting it. Lots of different ways to get involved and help us, you know, signal boost this message that America's wildlife are unique and wonderful and beautiful and deserve our protection, and that the National Wildlife Federation really, you know, can use everybody's help and everybody's voice in order for us to achieve that vision of having a future where wildlife are thriving right here in America.
I suggest that people go to the National Wildlife Federation's beautiful website, which is nwf.org. And I, for one, am going to be contacting a couple of friends of mine who are very, very gifted amateur photographers and encourage them to submit wildlife photos for your 50th annual photo contest. Just one more way to celebrate all of the beautiful, wonderful things that are around us.
Absolutely. And another example of one of the great programs that we do every year. So thanks for mentioning that one, too.
Very good. Very good. Last quick question. So how much of the work that you do for the National Wildlife Federation has you behind a desk versus out of doors where you really are happiest?
That is also a great question and a big misperception. I get a lot of people saying, oh, it must be so great to run around out in nature and, you know, interact with live animals all the time. And I have to, you know, burst their bubble and say the unfortunate reality is I'm just like most other people out there and do most of my work sitting indoors in front of a computer. So I try to carve out that, you know, in my personal time as much as I can to get outdoors. And again, I'm a big gardener. I love getting outside and getting my fingers in the dirt and planting native plants and attracting wildlife. It's a good reminder for all of us that, that a whole idea of less screen time and more green time, it's not just for kids, it's for adults too.
David Mizadrevsky is a naturalist with the National Wildlife Federation joining us during this National Wildlife Week. Thank you so much. Great to talk with you again. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. I hold in my hands a beautiful book from National Geographic, and in some ways I'm sort of holding the whole universe in my hands, which is quite an interesting experience. The reason is that this book has quite an ambitious scope to it. It's called Sizing Up the Universe, the Cosmos in Perspective. And the author of the book, co-author, Richard Gott III, professor of astrophysics at Princeton University, has tried to help us understand the scope of the universe, just how large it is, how large important bodies in the universe are, how far they are apart from each other, and trying to help us grasp all this beyond the mere numbers, which after a while utterly overwhelm us. And so it is a lesson in trying to give us perspective on the immensity of the universe. And along the way, we are also treated to absolutely gorgeous photographs of jaw-dropping beauty. And so I'm so excited for this opportunity to speak with Professor Gott about this book, again called Sizing Up the Universe, The Cosmos in Perspective, which comes to us from National Geographic. Professor Gott, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you.
looking forward to talking to you very much. I have to say right off the bat, one of the things I especially enjoyed was something you say, I believe, in the book's introduction about how in many cases children are drawn to astronomy the same way they're often drawn to dinosaurs because of the fact that kids love big things. And not much is bigger than the universe itself. I guess nothing is.
That's right. When I got interested in astronomy when I was 8 years old, and I was interested in the planets. Things in astronomy are even bigger than dinosaurs. So I got interested in astronomy.
And I guess what I really appreciate, too, is that when you first study astronomy, you're studying things like the order of the planets and the satellites revolving around them, and eventually things like our galaxy and so on. But boy, when you seriously study astronomy, you get away from some of that tangibility pretty quickly, and it becomes, in some ways, what at least feels like a much different science, a much different discipline than the more basic astronomy where we all begin. And I love the fact that your book really, in so many ways, is content with astronomy, in a sense, at its most basic, at its most accessible level, for as complex and mind-blowing as a lot of this is. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, yes. We start out by showing, you know, how big things look in the sky, how the ancient Greeks figured out, you know, how big the moon was, how big the sun was, how far away things are. And this has been steady progress over the centuries. Hubble discovered that there were other galaxies, that they were very far away. To give you an idea, if we shrink the Earth in size by a factor of a billion, we're all familiar with a billion, you know, a dollar will get you a hamburger, $1 billion makes you a billionaire. If you shrink by a factor of a billion the Earth, it will be as large as a marble. So if you have the Earth as large as a marble, the sun is a giant beach ball, 55 inches across, about 500 feet away. That's more than the length of a football field. And the nearest star on that scale is Proxima Centauri, which is about the size of a basketball, and it would be 25,000 miles away. And, you know, you drive that far in your car over the years. So it's an enormous distance just to the nearest star. And that's to say nothing of, you know, the fact that we have a whole galaxy. We live in a galaxy with 100 billion stars in them. So the distances out there are truly enormous.
Help us understand how we measure distance when we are talking about those kind of distances. I guess I don't mean what kind of numbers do we use, but more how do we accurately determine distances that are so vast?
Well, by parallax, by its 3D vision, really, we'll observe a star from one side of the Earth's orbit. 6 months later, the Earth moves to the other side of its orbit. We've learned from previous studies how big the Earth's orbit is, and so when you move 6 months away, the Earth moves to the other side of the sun, and you see that star from a different point of view. So against background stars, it shifts slightly. It's just like the 3D vision that you used in Avatar to see the things in the foreground or in the background. So we can see that the nearby stars figure out how far away they are. And we found that that they're on the scale that I talked about. If the sun's about 500 feet away, the nearest star would be about 25,000 miles away. That's how we discovered that.
As you discuss some of the more familiar heavenly bodies in the sky, you made a point that I had never really stopped to think about, which is the fact that when we look up in the sky, the sun and the moon appear to be almost exactly the same size. I mean, to our unaided eye, and of course they are vastly dissimilar in their actual size, but
almost identical in size and how they appear to us. It just made me realize how confusing that had to be for early man, and it probably led to centuries of a great misunderstanding about the nature of the sun and the moon. That's, I suppose, just sheer coincidence that they appear to be nearly identical in the sky.
That's fairly pretty much sheer coincidence. The size of the sun in apparent size, it's about half a degree, is pretty much determined by the fact that the Earth should have a reasonable temperature, that water shouldn't boil or freeze in the oceans. And if the sun were like twice as big in apparent size in the sky, the oceans would boil because it'd be like having four suns up in the sky if the sun were twice as big. So if the sun were twice as far away and only a quarter of a degree across in the sky, then the oceans would all freeze and we'd be... So for the Earth to be habitable, the sun has to be pretty much the size it is. The moon, being the size it is, produces tides that are kind of reasonable, and that can help your amphibians get onto the land, maybe. So the moon, being the size it is actually a little bit helpful to life as well. But as you say, this was confusing to people. Aristarchus was the first one that really figured out that the sun must be much further away than the moon. The first quarter moon and the last quarter moon, these are the phases of the moon. New moon, first quarter, full moon, last quarter, new moon again. These are separated by 1 week each, and so they're equally spaced around the moon's orbit. And the first quarter moon is when it's half illuminated by the sun. And so he could figure out that if this was the way the moon was being illuminated in its orbit, the sun had to be much further away than the size of the moon's orbit. If the sun were only twice as far away as the moon, then that space between first and last quarter would only take up a third of the month instead of a half a month. So by geometric reasoning, he figured out that the sun was much further away than the moon and therefore much bigger than the moon. And he could see that the Earth was about three times the size of the moon because he could see the Earth's shadow on the moon during a total lunar eclipse of the moon. And so he was able to deduce that the sun was bigger than the Earth, and therefore he thought that the Earth should go around the sun rather than the other way around. And so people didn't believe him, and because they didn't believe him, it took till Copernicus, about 1,700 years later, until we were finally convinced. So people could have figured this out in the ancient Greek days if they were just tiny bit smarter.
Or a little more open to what... Or been a little more open to what on the surface had to seem like a preposterous idea. I want to ask I want to ask you about something that I think is really important for all that we find in this book, and that is taken up early on. In what you title The Shape of the Sky. This is a point in the book in which you are really trying to help us sort of unleash ourselves from a view of how our galaxy and our universe are shaped that is too constrained in order to really take in its full magnificence. Help us understand what we need to do to really grasp the shape of the sky, as you put it.
Well, when you go out at night in dark sight, you can see the sky overhead. It looks like a dome overhead, and the Earth looks flat, and it goes out to the horizon like a plate, and there's a dome overhead. That's a hemisphere. That's half of a sphere. But you can't see the rest of the sky because the Earth blocks your view. So if you imagine putting on a spacesuit and then imagine the Earth would disappear suddenly, you could see the rest of the sky, which is another hemisphere below you. You could see the sun. It's below the surface of the Earth, but just your view of it was blocked before. The sun is still there. It's just down below you. So if the Earth were to disappear, you would be surrounded by a complete sphere of stars. We call this the celestial sphere. And you could see the the Milky Way going around in a circle around the sky. We live on a galaxy that looks like a dinner plate. We live in the plate. So if you look out in large distances, you're looking out in the plane of the plate. You see this band of stars, a faint band of stars going around the whole sky called the Milky Way. And the rest of the stars that you see scattered all over the sky, these are actually very close to us in the dinner plate. And these are the close stars, the bright stars. They're just as bright as the sun, in many cases brighter than the sun, but they're so far away that they look like tiny points of light. And this was realized only after Copernicus, but the ancient Greeks could have thought of that as well if they'd just been a little bit cleverer.
I'm reminded of a moment in one of the Star Trek motion pictures, the second one, The Wrath of Khan, where the Enterprise is confronted by another Federation ship that's been taken over by the villain of the movie, Khan, and they are both in a nebula where their sensors don't work, but what allows the Enterprise to outsmart Khan and the other ship is that they think spatially in every direction versus on a flat plane. And Khan, as he's flying this other ship around, is only thinking, in a sense, on that flat dinner plate, not up and down, which is the way when you watch the classic Star Trek TV series from the 60s, that's the only way we ever saw the Enterprise move, was along this flat plane as though there were a highway through space. And it's, in a sense, as we leap forward a couple of decades, the producers of Star Trek have made that same leap of understanding the galaxy as and the whole universe, for that matter, as this immense sphere rather than that flat dinner plate, which is usually how most of us envision all this.
Right. It's very important to think of the universe in three dimensions. I've studied galaxy clustering. And we found that there's a sponge-like connection of galaxies. The great clusters of galaxies are connected by filaments. It makes a sponge-like structure. And you really have to think in three dimensions to see that. And we find out there are great walls of galaxies connecting clusters of galaxies. Mario Jurich and I discovered this Sloan Great Wall of Galaxies, 1.37 billion light years across. And this is the largest structure in the universe. It got me in the Guinness Book of World Records, to my surprise. And it's a great record, too, because of all the records in the Guinness Book, there's the largest pickup truck, the largest pumpkin, you know, of all the largest things in the Guinness Book, we're the largest of the largest. So there's enormous structures out there, a chain of galaxies. These are all brought together by the action of gravity over the course of 13 billion years. And so thinking three-dimensionally rather than in a plane was very important for us to understand this cosmic web.
And you mentioned again back in that chapter called The Shape of the Sky, there are really only six human beings in history that have had the chance to actually take in the sky all at once, and that would be six Apollo astronauts.
Yes, these are Apollo astronauts that actually ventured outside their capsule to retrieve some experiments that were stored on the outside. They got a chance to look around the whole sky. The astronauts that are in the space shuttle, almost half their view is still blocked off by the Earth. They're in low Earth orbit, only a couple of hundred miles up. So they basically can only see half the sky, just like we can on Earth. And the Apollo astronauts who were inside their capsules, they just got to look out a little bitty window. But if you actually went out of your capsule, you could see the whole sky, and you would see the Earth over there, and the moon over there, and the sun over there, and then all the stars surrounding you. So it's a view that only a few people have had.
Right. And in a sense, your book is an effort to give all of us that view, or at least help us grasp the notion of what that view might be like. I want you to have the opportunity to talk a moment about some of the beautiful photographs that are in your book that were taken in a surprisingly simple fashion in somebody's backyard. Tell us about where some of these wonderful, especially colorful photographs come from and how accessible these kind of photographs are to anybody who just happens to have the right equipment in their backyard.
Well, a number of the photographs in our book were taken by my co-author, Bob Vanderbilt, who's another professor at Princeton, but he's an amateur astronomer. And when I was a kid, when I was 8 years old, starting to be interested in astronomy was really a backyard hobby. You could go out and see the moon, the planets. You could see the M31 galaxy, Andromeda galaxy. You could see nebulas. But what's happened over the years is light pollution has brightened the sky so that the faint objects like the galaxies and the nebula disappeared from view. But luckily, we've discovered astrophotography. We have CCD cameras now that are very sensitive, very much more sensitive than film. And we have filters so that you can filter out most of the light from the sky pollution and just look at one wavelength that the nebula might be emitting, a hydrogen alpha light that's coming from a nebula. So Bob has been able to take pictures from his backyard that are astonishing, that rival the ones taken in the largest observatories. We have a picture in the book of the Eagle Nebula that Bob took from his backyard, and we put it side by side with the best picture of this from the Hubble Space Telescope. And you can see the Hubble Space Telescope picture's a bit sharper. Bob's has better colors because he's plotting it at the correct colors. The nebula really looks red, and the Hubble picture looks green because they're using a false color system to illustrate various scientific points. So it's amazing that someone from their backyard in New Jersey with a 10-inch diameter telescope can take a picture that would rival the Hubble Space Telescope. And if you want to take a picture of a planet, we now have the digital cameras allow us to take videos where we can take hundreds of pictures of this in a sequence, and then there's software programs that will pick out those moments of great scene where there's a moment of great clarity in the atmosphere and you can see the surface features better. It'll throw the bad pictures away automatically and add up the good pictures to give you really wonderful pictures of the planets. So we have in there a picture of Jupiter where you can see Jupiter's red spot. You can see the cloud layers in Jupiter. Bob has taken wonderful pictures of the planets and the moon. So we're hoping that this book, by showing off some of the beautiful pictures that you can take from your backyard, will encourage kids who love to take pictures with their digital cameras and put them on their computer, might be interested in taking up this as a hobby, because it's really become a backyard hobby once again.
It's very, very good. Spreads also that compare for us, for instance, the difference between Katrina and Jupiter's Great Red Spot, and the difference between the Grand Canyon and some of the features on Mars, and the difference between the United States and one single sunspot helps us understand how small we are and how immense this universe is. The book, again, is called Sizing Up the Universe. And Dr. Richard Gott, I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this beautiful book.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we'll continue our examination or celebration of National Wildlife Week by playing several interviews out of The Morning Show archives, including one with the author of a wonderful book called The Song of Insects. On Thursday's Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Dr. James Ripley about the band concert that is coming up this weekend called Honoring Loved Ones. But we'll also talk with Dr. Ripley as a member of the COVID Coordination Committee at Carthage about Carthage's decision to allow the public to attend Carthage's music events for the remainder of the spring semester. It was a decision that was made carefully and cautiously, and of course is one more sign that perhaps we are inching towards something resembling normal life one of these days. So we'll be talking about this move by Carthage to allow the public with limited seating to attend its music events in person. And on Friday, Nan Calvert, and that will be a lovely way to finish out the morning show's tribute to National Wildlife Week. We'll be talking with the author of a nationally published book about how we can garden in such a way as to